Between the Lines with Andrea Gilligan. This is News Talk.
Well, a very good morning and you're welcome along to News Talks Between the Lines programme with myself, Andrea Gilligan, where we'll be taking a closer look at some of the main stories and issues of interest. My thanks to Richard Chambers for filling in for the past 2 weeks. And you can also listen back to our podcast on newstalk.com, iTunes or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can get in contact with us this morning by emailing betweenthelines@newstalk.com or on Twitter at myself at Andrea Gilligan. Well, coming up today, we'll be discussing the issue of consent and sex education in a week where the Department of Education ordered a review of relationships and sexual education in our schools. We'll be asking, how much should children know about sex education and consent? Should parents have any input in what their children learn? And when is the right age to start talking to young children about sex education? Well, joining us to discuss our panel this morning, Colman Nochter, child and adolescent psychotherapist at St Patrick's Mental Health Service, Sinead Nugent from the Sphere 17 Regional Youth Service in Dublin, where she's helped facilitate sexual health education and consent workshops for teenagers. Elaine Burns, a doctoral researcher in the School of Psychology at NUI Galway. Her research focuses on sexual behaviour and the communication of consent and is also an experienced facilitator of consent workshops at third level. And also a Dr. Padraig McNeela, a lecturer in psychology at NUI Galway, who with Elaine helped to devise smart consent workshops in colleges right across the country. You're all very welcome. Just to say, I suppose, first of all, while we're trying to encourage young people to talk more about sex and consent, some of the language that will be used and the issues discussed on this programme this morning may not be appropriate for smaller ears, so we'll just leave that up to people themselves to decide. So this week the Minister for Education, Richard Bruton, said that there needed to be more effective communication between schools and parents regarding the teaching of relationships and sexuality and sexual education in schools. It's because it is a 20-year-old curriculum. Colman Nochter, it's timely, I suppose, that this change is happening.
Well, I think it is. I mean, it's probably a bit slow, to be honest. I think we're a bit behind the curve. I mean, working in child psychiatry, the landscape has completely changed in terms of children's socialisation processes, their exposure to material that they are expected to understand when they actually can't. And it's a real dilemma for parents to, you know, are you shrinking the innocence of childhood by introducing these concepts really early? Are you introducing something that is potentially that they won't understand or traumatise? Or are you leaving them unskilled or unprepared for a world in which they're going to be exposed to this material anyway? And I suppose it is a dilemma for parents to decide, you know, how much do they want their children to know? Mm. And it's a dilemma for all of us to decide how much do they need to know. And what we do know is that, you know, childhood is shrinking in terms of, if you're looking at in terms of psychological difficulties that young people traditionally would have presented with at 14, 15, we're finding those difficulties, which are largely stress and anxiety related, to present at the 11 and 12 year old range. So it is the onset of stress and anxiety is clear, and the onset of puberty, sexuality, they're huge players in what causes youngster stress.
And I suppose just even in your own kind of daily professional working life, you're just, maybe to give listeners a little bit of context, you're working with children from all backgrounds, all different, I suppose, experiences as well. So you're able to give us firsthand, you know, the reality of what it is the children are now facing.
Yeah, and I think from one of the major players that I would think at the moment a real struggle is with identity. So young people trying to find out who they are. And they're trying to sculpt this identity with themselves with so much feedback, so much exposure. And it's a real challenge for them because they don't know should they be who the world wants them to be? Should they be themselves? And where the line of self-declaration begins and ends is becoming much more blurred. So a lot of young people feel very unsafe and very unsure, and maturity brings with that expectation that you know who you are and you announce your identity both sexually, academically, in sporting prowess, etc. And I would experience a lot of young people who experience maturity fears. So growing up is something that they find really difficult. So yes, they're going along with the conversation, preparing for the teenage disco and getting their makeup done and all that sort of stuff. But inside, they are absolutely terrified of what they're expected to behave like in this occasion, how they're supposed to be, and, you know, becoming an object of desire. And I'm speaking primarily probably around young girls who I would work with. You know, there's so much expectation around performance and how you need to portray yourself. And it would be naive to think that social media and, you know, that huge identification, how we announce our identities through filtered images and body image and, you know, being mature and being, you know, I suppose having a degree of social kudos, that the huge pressure for young children.
Okay. So would you put a lot of that down to the social media?
I think that's a huge player in it. I think it has changed the landscape in what we're trying to deal with. But I also think the exposure, it's not just social media. You just look at radio and over the last number of months, the amount of times that I've three small children, I've had to turn down the radio at various times when we're discussing, you know, quite detailed accounts of incidents that have occurred. And you're just, I mean, even concepts like terrorism, a concept of, you know, how do I prepare my child for all of this exposure? Mm-hmm. And we find ourselves having to introduce education and awareness far more earlier than we would have had to do before.
Yeah.
The protection of children from material is far more difficult, and surveillance of their exposure is almost a moot point.
Okay.
So we have to almost, the off button has to come from within them. And as parents, teachers, government, legislators, we have to almost provide that voice in their head. But I do think we're asking children to do something that cognitively and emotionally they may not be able to do.
Okay. Can I just ask you, Sinead Nugent, I know you work with the Sphere 17 Regional Youth Service in Dublin, and there you help to kind of facilitate the sexual health education and consent workshops. And we'll come to that maybe in a little bit. But just in terms of your own background, how much of an overlap would you see from the kind of, I suppose, sentiments that Coleman has already raised here this morning?
Yeah, I would totally agree with a lot of what Coleman has just said there. I think from the point of view of being a youth worker, I meet the young people in the community, you know, so I'm seeing them before they might even be getting to you, Coleman, so we would refer them on. So I definitely believe that they are struggling, and as a youth worker, my role, I can only speak about that, is to help them to make sense of that. They are being exposed to all this on social media or whatever, but during the sexual health programmes, I think it's key that we help them to make sense. So I think at the beginning, just to talk about my kind of background, I would have been very focused on having all the information, all the facts all the time, thinking I needed to be an expert. And through my 12 years, that has completely changed. You know, it's just really about facilitating that conversation, helping them to make sense of it, helping them to know, yeah, you are seeing that. It's almost like they've missed a step somewhere along the way. So I suppose my programming now would definitely focus more on the emotional relationship, the emotional development. Follow on from that would be consent, you know, which I'm sure we'll get to later.
And that's something that I know you talk quite a lot about. But even just in the I suppose the kids or the children that you're dealing with at, you know, youth workshops and at youth worker age, what are their attitudes to consent? Do they know about it or know what it is?
So my age group is very broad. So I suppose it's hard to give a sweeping statement there. So it's 10 to 24 and we start, you know, exposing them or asking them to become interested or would they like to take part in sexual health programs at like 15 and now more recently kind of younger, 14. But I think they would have a very clear understanding of the age of consent. And maybe that's kind of as far as it goes.
So it's more the legal parameters is what they're aware of, really.
Andrea, yeah. So like the giving and the getting consent, you really have to delve into, you know. So they're getting, I think, their notions from their peers, social media,
television programs, all of that kind of thing. Can I just ask you, Elaine Burns? I know that a lot of your own kind of work mainly focused in the consent workshops that you do. I suppose really more specifically at third level, but just in your own kind of experience in carrying out this kind of research, what do you see as the attitudes to consent?
Well, I suppose my perspective is informed from two strands of my work. One is with third level and the other is with at second level in the work that I do with Richie Sadlier. But one of the things that we see consistently in the third level workshops is that, and Pother, you'll be aware of this, that students have a really good understanding of consent from what I call an operational perspective. So if you say define consent, they'll rattle off a definition of it. But then when you go into vignettes or scenarios where consent may be ambiguous, that's where they struggle, or that's where they realise that consent can be a grey area. And then at third level, when you introduce alcohol into the mix, the hooking up culture, my own research, and Podrick is my PhD advisor, we conducted a survey in 2015 with students in NUI Galway, and that culminated with the SHAG report, Sexual Health and Attitudes Galway report, that was published in December. And that gave us a baseline of data on student attitudes and behaviours that we didn't have in this country mm-hmm. prior to that. And we used scales and measures that were used for the first time outside of the United States. And then building on that work, then I interviewed students as part of the qualitative element of my PhD. And one of the things that was consistent in the interview work was when we asked them about their experience of RSE at second level, it was either non-existent or confined to, and you'll be aware of this, Sinead, as well, mm-hmm. and Coleman, it was confined to biological processes. There was very little, or there was nothing on the emotional aspects mm-hmm. of it, and nothing, of course, on consent.
Okay.
Because the program is 20 years old.
Yeah, and everyone has, I mean, even listening this morning, this kind of vague recollection of how you probably learned about sex education in school, or there was some, you know, there might have been some mention of it in a part of a class, but it was never something that you had, you know, well, certainly in my time, which isn't terribly long ago, you know, a huge level of detail or discussion about. And you were kind of embarrassed in the class if your teacher even mentioned it.
And nearly as embarrassed as the teacher themselves.
Yeah, yeah. So, well, that's another
that's
part.
It, isn't
that's
it?
A real issue.
Can I just bring you in as well, Dr. Padraig McNeela as well? I know we'll come to the smart consent workshops that yourself and Elaine have worked on in a little bit, but just give us your own kind of, I suppose, view or perception of the attitudes towards consent in Ireland among, particularly, I really suppose, among young people and even third level students today.
Well, I think you can see it in terms of two sides of the same coin, really, because when the research that I've done over the past 5 years in this area, there's really encouraging attitudes and perspectives and support among young people for active consent and, you know, really doing all the right things. But then at the same time, we don't have to go very far to find a lot of barriers that people will also talk about.
In what way, though?
Well, so that people will say, like, well over 80% of the people that I've surveyed will say verbal consent, you know, should be sought. But then when we drill down into that, they will also talk about barriers that they would see in terms of actually putting that into place, like maybe the other person doesn't actually believe that too. So when we put the same question to students, do you think your peers also feel this way? Then that figure would drop down to more like 30 or 40%. So there's the social norms gap. There's a lack of realization on the part of young people that their peers are actually very positively disposed towards active consent and verbal consent. And that's one of the first barriers, I think, that we need to break
to
down.
To address, okay. Yeah. And how would you see, just even your own experience, like what would you see from the response from students as perhaps the way to go about actually breaking down those barriers?
So by talking about it.
Okay.
And also, so we do, this is why we first of all kind of documented some of these problems, you know, that students kind of felt that there was lack of consent kind of awareness in schools and that kind of thing. But we can you know, delve into problems a lot. The really important thing is to find solutions. And so the next step and the thing that I've really been occupied by over the past number of years is to develop a workshop that is using research evidence that will allow students to explore what consent is, both within the kind of immediate group that you're in, but also then we can draw on findings from up to 3,000 students that we've surveyed and done interview work mm-hmm. with. So you're really getting that social norms myth busted in that case. And you're seeing that the people around you, you know, in the room also feel, you know, positive about
okay.
it.
Can I just ask Coleman Nocter, the point we made at the outset, the Minister for Education, Richard Bruton, just only recently announced the fact that there's going to be this review of our 20-year curriculum of relationships and sexuality, sexual education. How do you think that review should, like, in what way should it take place, or how should it be conducted?
Quickly. I think, I mean, we need to look at the material you're trying to teach here. This is not mechanics. So you go back to junior cert biology, which was my sex education introduction in some respects, yeah. or junior cert science. This is not about mechanics. The mechanics is what is known. It is the emotionality. And it's exactly what we're just talking about. You know, that kind of make love, not porn almost idea. So the emotionality involves all those social norm pressures. So you're in that situation, you're thinking, what will people say if I say no here? What if, you know, so all of these are players that we, as Elena said, you know the operational definition, but operationalizing that in a situation where there's maybe drinking taken, there's pressures, there's what's the fallout going to be, is really, really difficult. The other thing is that, you know, we're raising awareness and we're having these conversations, that's really good, but we're doing it against I suppose the porn sector, which is providing, I think, the core education for young people, unfortunately. And what we know about pornography is obviously, as an adult watching pornography, you can define that this is not reality. Yeah. This is, and the reason that we engage in watching pornography is because it's fantasy. And, you know, so, but as a 13-year-old, you're not seeing two people in a sexual act, you're seeing a relationship. And if that's what you believe a relationship to be, and you try to emulate that as what you believe intimacy to be, through misadventure, you may get yourself in an awful lot of trouble. So the wave of education has to look at pornography and say, you know, this is fake news in some respects. This is not a relationship. This is not how things really occur. And it needs to have a counter curriculum around intimacy, around emotionality. Like, for instance, I'd have young people now who had talked to, let's say, the last year I remember speaking to you, two young people who were going to their debs, and they didn't know any boys. You know, they didn't. They went to an all-girls school. They played camogie and they did ballet.
So they actually
they didn't have any interaction. They didn't have the group of kids sitting out on the green having a chat and having boys as part of your development. So your source of information is theoretical in some respects, or it's mediated through Snapchat messages. But they would say, this guy will like my pictures, but if he saw me on the street, he'd cross the road. You know, so there's that, you know, my laboratory of life was the 65 bus, you know, where the girls' school got on and my boys' school got on. And it was a laboratory of life where I learned everything I needed to know outside. It wasn't a curriculum. It was that bus journey through uncomfortableness and, you know, who has what written on their pencil case. And, oh, my God, did she look at me that way? And all that sort of stuff has to be worked out. Yeah. And I really get back to that point of those steps being missed, where we're getting a Tinderization of society, where it is swipe left, right, the hookup culture.
You don't have to you can actually nearly go through your life and not interact with anybody.
Exactly.
It can all be done through phone or computer.
But look at the dating culture. You know what I mean? The notion of actually going out and meeting someone through a non-mediated means is probably the exception as opposed to the rule now. And that seeps into teenage culture as well. So you're possibly putting yourself at risk meeting someone who you don't really know an awful lot about. Okay. And, you know, so those are all kind of social elements that the consent issue is, yes, it's most certainly a part of that. But there's wider educational, life educational pieces that I think the sex education modules need to incorporate.
Can I just ask you, Sinead Nugent, just before we talk about how the RSE new or revised curriculum might actually look? But I know you run and facilitate kind of sexual health education and consent workshops for teenagers. So just on that point that Coleman was talking about, and we're talking about this review of the RSE curriculum or how it might maybe look in the future, can you maybe just give an outline for people listening this morning as to how your own workshops kind of work? Like, what format do they take?
Youth work would kind of come at it from a very interactive approach anyway, you know, and we would have relationships with the young people to begin with. So that's, again, a great place to be starting. But consent session looks like this. We would show them a few videos, you know, the cup of tea video from a few years back.
I actually only heard about that in the last couple of days.
So I think it's really good, that clip for adults. Now, I've showed it to the young people that I work with and they don't relate to it at all.
Really?
Yeah, so I've shown it, and then we more recently start to show a Trinity College one, which is really good. Maybe they can relate more to that. It's a bit of fun. But more importantly, I think we would focus in our youth work team around like consent and linking consent with your gut feeling. So I think it's really important to talk about consent outside the sexual kind of arena first, so they can kind of translate it then eventually when they get to that stage.
And how would that work?
Yeah, we would introduce, like, it's a window of tolerance type exercise that we would do. So we would ask for two volunteers within the group to step forward. One stands one end of the room, the other stands the other. So one person is asked to stand still and the other person is asked to walk towards that person standing still. Person standing still is asked to put their arm out or give us a signal when that's as far as they want that person to come to them. So then once they've done that, we ask them, well, why did you do that? And, you know, why was it that point? And how were you thinking? And how were you feeling? And did you think it first? Did you feel it first? And then the same with the person who was walking towards them. How did they feel in that situation?
Okay.
And then again, with the group who were observing, what did you notice about that person? Did you notice their jaw tighten, their fist clench? So it's really just empowering them to feel that gut feeling, you know, and to trust it as well. But I suppose we would have variations on that exercise. So the person who has been asked to stand still will ask to turn side on, and then turn their back. And it's just to kind of relate that maybe in everyday situations where you might be standing at a bus side to side to someone, or, you know, every girl or woman has, you know, experienced the walking home on their own, you know, in an alley, those footsteps. So it's not to create fear. It's just to remember those feelings and to trust them. And it's all about empowering them, I think.
I thought it was interesting, actually, the way you mentioned that idea of the gut feeling, because even now in your early 30s, you still have that as well.
Consent is a whole body experience, you know, that's it. And it should be pleasurable for both.
Are they mixed in terms of gender?
Yeah, we've had a few light bulb moments along the way. One was that we weren't talking about consent enough. Second was that, where possible, it makes so much sense to work with boys and girls. And I suppose it gets rid of that notion of the girls are being told one thing in one room and the boys are being told another in another room. It's about, you know, having that safe place that the youth workers can provide and for them to challenge each other and to, you know, knock those gender stereotypes or whatever and hear from each other. So if you can, mix it. But I understand that that's not always possible and practical.
And I wanted to ask on that idea of the practicalities of that, have you faced any opposition to workshops like that, or even the mixed gender workshops, even maybe from parents or other community groups or...
No, we haven't. Anytime, like, we'd always send a letter home and a phone call home to participants that are taking part and have put themselves forward. Parents are so delighted that we are doing it. And they give you like little snippets of, well, would you talk to them about this, or would you talk to them about that as well? Maybe our team, even our own youth work team, we might have had like a few kind of disputes about whether it should be mixed or not. I think it comes down to, again, the relationship that you have with the group of young people.
And that they have with themselves.
Exactly.
The dynamic.
Can I just even bring you in, Emmeline Byrne, on that? Because it just, maybe give us your view on the next step as to how this RSE curriculum maybe might work with the kind of research you've been doing and the kind of work in schools as well that you've been carrying out.
Well, one of the first thing that Richie and I do with a new group, we're working in his alma mater, right, which is an all-boys school. Right. And the first thing we do is we conduct a pre-module survey just to get a baseline on their understanding of sex, sexual health and sexuality. And of course, that's very limited. Now, the boys are fortunate enough in that they have had RSE. They have had an element of it. But of course, it's again, it's from a biological perspective and it's the current curriculum. So we also ask them, what are the three things that they most want to see in the module? And the three things that consistently come up are consent, healthy relationships, and contraception.
Okay.
So I they need to be core.
And that's
to this
coming
new RSE.
From students.
That's coming from themselves. And that's another thing about the new curriculum that I think I know the minister is going to engage in a consultative process with principals, teachers, parents. But the students' voice needs to be heard in that.
Okay.
And what the students themselves want.
And because I'm right in saying that there, or am I right in saying that there's nothing like this from a state advisory body or a state advisory board that's being carried out? This is something that you are doing through your own work with schools.
Well, Richie delivers a mental fitness module in the school. And
that's just in one particular school, though.
And that's, it was an uncomfortable realisation for us at the beginning that it's 1 year of one school that's single gender. And now it's really a source of frustration that a programme such as ours, I'm not saying it's a nirvana or anything, but such as ours, or the work that Sinead is doing, that's a big issue that I have with what we're doing, what you're doing, what AIDS West in Galway are doing, what Anna Marie O'Shea in Kerry is doing, is there's a lack of consistency. Like the students that experience what we do are very fortunate, but it should be something that's available consistently to all students.
Okay. Dr. Padraig McNeill, I want to pick up on some of the points there raised by Elaine Byrne. She talked about the idea, I suppose, of three kind of main principal points that were being brought up by some of the students that they deal with in some of the school workshops they carry out. From your own research, are they kind of the key areas that you would think would need to be addressed as part of this revised RSE schools curriculum?
I suppose the first thing is to say, hopefully whatever happens doesn't sort of put sexual consent and sexual health on some kind of island, if you like, in terms of schools and the well-being program. Because, like, if you look at the junior cycle well-being curriculum that's been revised, the only thing really that is missing is words like consent and positive sexual health. Because all of that openness around personal development, responsibility, well-being, you know, is there. But because of historical issues, we just haven't seen that openness around sexual health. So I think if you look at all the state policies around youth development, they are speaking the same language. There's clearly a lot of work to do in terms of the translation of that into practical resources and materials that people can use within schools and the kind of training and support within schools and for teachers. There's many examples of good practice. There's the Real You program. There's Before You Decide, the Tuzla Manuela Riedo program that is starting with Galway Rape Crisis Centre, where I'm a member of the board of directors there. That's really forging the way. They're using a lot of video-based materials, and we'll be reaching out to like 1,000 students or so over the next year. So there's a lot of things that are happening to bridge that gap between policy and practice. In terms of what the underlying kind of principles should be, the work that we're doing currently is to, I suppose, support the workshop development also through developing media resources. I suppose one of the things that we do find is, you know, 3/4 of students say that they weren't happy with the sexual with the sexual health education that they received in schools. This is, you know, students in college. So if we put something like a consent workshop to them, they don't have any context to understand what might be happening there. It could be seen as a threatening thing. People will often understand words like consent in terms of non-consent, that you're actually going to talk to me now about sexual assault and rape. That conversation is really important. Sexual assault and sexual violence, those words do not appear in the SPHE curriculum for the junior cycle or for the senior cycle. The word consent does not appear in either document. So, but you can see that there are, you know, developments afoot. So when we are we're currently working with students, and the model that we're engaged on at the moment is in terms of confidence within the person, communication, which would be the skills that you would have in order to talk to your partner or use nonverbal consent or know when to stop, and also community, that we're also going to work on the social norms surrounding the person and their partner, so that there's good awareness of the amount of positive disposition that there is. So I think you need to take that positive perspective and realize that there is a lot of positive intentions, but what we are lacking are practical tools.
Okay. Coleman Nochter, is that something that you would experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to introduce, I really hope the review doesn't come to one class, because this isn't one conversation. Yeah. This is a series of conversations.
So not a transition year style thing.
Yeah, we need to move away from the handing the book at 12 and hoping for the best, and that's my job done, because the complexities of all of these nuanced interactions will, the social environment gets more complex as you get older. So the onset of psychological stress to an 11-year-old is quite difficult to that of different to that of a 14-year-old. So we need to sophisticate the conversation as it goes. I really want us to move away from the shock and awe issue. You know, this isn't like in drink driving campaigns and smoking campaigns, it's helpful to, you know, show these crashes, and because we don't want people to do that, but we do want people to engage in intimacy, but just we want them to learn the right way. So I think if we go in talking about STIs and pregnancies, that is, children see that as an effort to control, not educate. So you've switched off from the start. It needs to be a conversation around this that evolves and develops over time. And what Elaine is saying is so true. You know, this occurring in pockets of the country, in and these very lucky young people who are having these things, but there's a vast array of young people who don't. They get the book at 12 and they have to hope for the best, or they have to turn to Google or whoever it is to answer their questions. But what I would say is, when we introduce it, there is a degree of it depends on the child. A child who's highly tuned to being anxious, you know, when you're introducing a concept like consent, you would have to pace that very, you know, talking about private parts, and that's what daddy or mommy or the doctor can see that, but nobody else. And maybe they might not reach a stage past that till 9 or 10 or 11, and then you might introduce another more, you know, about kissing or whatever it might be. But another child who's kind of seems to be escalating through their development far too quickly, you might need to pace that up a little bit and make them more prepared. So you're preparing each child. I mean, I have an issue with parenting strategy saying this strategy fits all, because it's every parent has to parent every child differently.
Okay.
Some will need a firm, kind of clear approach. Others, a far more softly approach.
So should it start with the parents at home, and then parents know that, well, in first class or second class or third class in primary school, my kid is going to experience, you know, certain amount of RSE education? Or should it be left to the parents to, I mean, start this at an earlier stage at home?
I mean, if we gather the idea that as Padraig was saying, this is a social norm issue, it has to come from all strands of the conversation. Mm-hmm. Parents have to be having the conversation, teachers having to have the conversation, so that it kind of migrates down into the young people having the conversation. Any strategy is most effective when the student body is behind it. If they feel it's imposed upon them, yeah, they'll push against it. Any anti-bullying policy that I've ever seen has been most effective when the young people themselves develop it, rather than it being a leaflet on the wall. So it is about buy-in, but it is about parents supporting that, and, you know, legislation supporting that, and I guess social media companies supporting that as well, and everyone having that kind of... we're trying to create a culture change here, and that takes buy-in from all angles. But I think there is a parental responsibility to introduce it, because you know your child best. But I understand the teacher's fears around, you know, the parents coming in and being upset about it. And I think the clarity around that is possible. But I would probably leave the school stuff more generic, and then maybe the one-to-one more probably intricate conversations to happen at home on a one-to-one, perhaps.
Sorry, yes, I think there's only so much that you can do as a professional, you know, so it does really come down to parents having those conversations as well. And I do think it's really important that the people who are delivering the programmes are there because they want to be, and that they're passionate about it.
Yeah.
Because if you're not, you know, the young people are going to smell that and run a mile. Mm. And you can't make people deliver something that they don't want to deliver too. You know, you have to be comfortable
doing that as well, actually. Yeah. Can I just ask you, Sinead, when you are, I suppose, talking separately to even girls and boys in the different workshops that you carry out as a youth worker, do you hear a difference between the two genders in terms of their views or how they talk about consent?
Yeah, I would hear it, yeah. You know, I'm not making that sweeping statement again, but the young people that come in to me, I would see a difference, yeah, between, you know, the girls and the boys. Again, they know the legal age, but when it comes down to it, I suppose the girls would think that once you've started something, you got to keep going, you know. So it's really mind-blowing for them to hear an adult say, guys, you could be right about to, you know, get stuck into the last bit, and you can say no. That is your right to do that. And then sure, they're like, oh, sure, we'd be called a prick tease or whatever. You know, these are real genuine concerns of young people. And then for girls, they've got a double end, because if they don't go, if they don't do it, they're being called a tease. And if they do, they're afraid they might be slut shamed, you know. So it's about, I suppose, having those conversations about, okay, so why is it like that for girls, or do boys experience that too? So it's about addressing their real concerns.
And just in your own experience as well, Sinead, would you find that some of the boys that you're dealing with, or the male teenagers, are they open to those kind of conversations and discussing all of this? Are they happy to participate in these kind of conversations?
Yeah, definitely. It's done again, you know, walk and debate, interactive, not behind a desk or anything like that. It's a bit of fun. We will meet them at their level. We'll talk their language. And I think there's a lot of stereotypes about boys and what's expected of them, and the pressure is on them too. Mm. You know, they don't know it all, and we kind of allow them to have that conversation that, guys, you must be feeling the pressure too, because you're expected to lead it out or whatever. So yeah, sometimes girls feel that they have to be the more submissive one, and the boys need to know everything. So they are open, in my experience.
Can I just ask you as well, Emmeline Burns, in terms of the kind of workshops that you do, even with Richie Sadler, do you find that idea of using the language sometimes that the kids themselves use, does that help you to have a better relationship with them in terms of giving them that openness to talk freely about their views of sexual education and sex and consent? Does that help to kind of just be kind of as frank and as open as Sinead was there, and just the kind of language that they're using?
Absolutely, and that's something that we do on day one. Is we discuss the language that's used around sex. And of course, a lot of their language then is influenced in part by pornography. Yeah. Whether they understand the terminology, they know the terms. And something that I'm very much aware of with the boys is that they are aware of consent and the issue of consent, but it's from a very negative perspective. There's a very negative connotation. And it's from the perspective of sexual violence.
Okay.
And one of the things that we encourage them to understand, and I distill it down because I think how I would speak about consent at third level and second level are very different. It's distilling it down to respect and boundaries. And that's something that we can start in Montessori with children and work on that all the way up so that they have an understanding and a cognizance of, well, consent, it's respectful, and it's me understanding my boundaries and respecting other people's boundaries. And then you introduce in second level the sexual consent element of it. But the boys as well, we would do, and I know in the smart consent workshops, there are vignettes that are used to you know, for the students to evaluate perhaps ambiguous situations that they may find themselves in. We've developed much simpler ones, or more age appropriate for the second level, because I think that would be too much for them to be exposed to ones that involve sex. So maybe heavy petting and that we'd have in the ones that we use with the second level students, for them to understand what consent means and how they would articulate it and how they would convey it and how they would communicate it. And another thing that's really, really important, the boys are defensive. Do you find that, Sinead?
Yeah, just as
very defensive. Like, you'll see that at third level as well. But something that's really important to me, and from facilitating the consent workshops at third level, and it took me a while to introduce this perspective that I have, that we need equality of responsibility in the communication of consent. Because while I say the students would have a good operational, definitional perspective of it, it's very much from the perspective of permission is sought, and permission is by the male in a heteronormative situation, and permission is given by the female. And what we encourage with the boys is to think about it as bidirectional, and that there's a mutuality to it. That the onus, and that's another thing that they're acutely aware of, is that the onus, they think that the onus of responsibility is on them. And we're saying that in a healthy and a respectful and a trusting relationship, that we would be encouraging them to be involved in, that it's both of you together discussing and communicating and making sure that the other person is doing what you want to do.
Okay. Do you find that they don't have the language sometimes? I think they think it's bizarre that it would kill the mood.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What do you expect me to do? Like,
you
just
that
say,
yeah. Potter, don't you, that they don't have.
The thing of, you know, should I get a contract, or how formal do you want to make this?
Yeah.
But of course, verbal consent, somebody might say, oh, will I get a condom? That was verbal consent, wasn't it?
Indirectly.
But, you know, let's widen that out and see about building people's confidence to talk about it more directly. The other thing is to be aware of the fact over 80% of students that I survey certainly also say, I would use nonverbal means of consent. And there is a debate about this. Should it always be verbal? Well, as I've said, you know, verbal, I could have done verbal consent by saying, will I get a condom? But that isn't quite... You could have nonverbal styles of consent that are actually clearer than that. So I think we have to be open to working with people where they are, and if they are going to be using nonverbal consent, to acknowledge that and to support that. And one of the vignettes that I use in the Smart Consent workshop is leaving the group with a smile. So the woman in the story smiles and then sex takes place. So is that sufficient? And It is ambiguous. We've spent a lot of time kind of finding these where often you'll get a 50-50 split. And so that opens up the debate for people to explore. Why might a smile mean consent validly in some situations, if you know the person, if the relationship is well established? And why would it be dodgy? Because there's a lot of alcohol, because it's on a hookup and so forth. These are the nuances that kind of go beyond the cup of tea video. So you do need that kind of clear messaging, that if you've only got 30 seconds, that people grasp the principles. But we work with people within the space of an hour, and we can do a lot of advanced kind of discussion with people around the impact of alcohol, nonverbal consent, and encouraging people on verbal and nonverbal, but then also addressing the issue of passive consent. Because again, over 70% of young adults will say, I would actually let something happen, and that would be my way of indicating consent.
Of consenting,
but there's many occasions where that is not valid because that person is very intoxicated, they're scared, and so forth. So we have to gently kind of nudge people towards a more positive model while not, you know, invalidating what they're doing already.
Just one point I want to just to touch on today, and that it, I suppose really it comes from maybe a concern from teachers and from parents about the idea of revising the RSE curriculum. Coleman, Nochter, if I can just ask you about the idea of school's ethos, because so many of our schools in Ireland, you know, 90% of them at least are probably Catholic schools, and some parents might, you know, think, well, I've sent my kid to a Catholic school. I want them to experience kind of Catholic teachings. And perhaps if we have a very general RSE curriculum, that might go against the I suppose Catholic ethos of the school, and maybe that's not something I want. Is that something, just in your own professional experience working obviously as a child and adolescent psychotherapist, is it something that you think some parents might have a difficulty with?
I think some of the perceived fear that parents will have is in our own heads. I really do believe that. And I think Sinead's point, I mean, I wouldn't imagine there's been many people have non-consented for people to attend your course, because I think parents genuinely are really anxious that their children find this out. I think mums of boys especially, who don't want their child to get in lots of trouble through misadventure, they don't particularly feel skilled enough to have this conversation. So when the offer of it is, I think the denominational issue is probably less of an issue when it comes to parents. But I think there is a fear, and has always been a fear, that if you go into the school to talk about something, that you'll encourage a kind of an outbreak of it. So if we have a sexual health conversation, we're going to have teenage pregnancies in 9 months' time because you've come in and do that. Okay. But that's the same when we go and talk about suicide or mental health problems, that there's this almost contagion effect that conversation creates. It's putting ideas in their heads. I don't think this is a conversation that is in any way putting anything in your head situation, rather than it is an absolutely essential conversation to have. But I'm going to complexify this by saying I don't think there is a one-size-fits-all for the application of this, because each of us in this room will have a different line as to our comfort in terms of sexuality. There's a great line, you know, I don't know what pornography is, but I know it when I see it. Because what pornography is to you, to me, to Elaine, to Sinead, to Padraig, will all be different. And so this is a general, I think it has to be a thematic around emotionality, as opposed to, you know, obviously you have to use terms that people are using. Parents might have a difficulty with that. We've all been horrified by the terms that were being used in the media in the last while. But it's not about the term, it's about the meaning of the term for you. And it's about your consent to engage in something that you are comfortable with. And I think if you sell it from that point of view, I would think no matter what the denomination, it should be something that's encouraged. And I wouldn't anticipate that the barriers that we expect might not actually accrue when this starts to be rolled out. Okay. I just hope it's rolled out in the right way.
Can I ask you, Elaine Byrne, on that, as somebody that works, I suppose, in schools, have you found that the ethos of the school is it a deterrent for some parents in terms of allowing the participation or wanting their kids maybe to opt out?
It's a Catholic school that Richie and I are facilitating the module in. And parents were sent a letter at the beginning of the school year telling them that their children would be participating in the sexual health module, and they had the option to opt out. Okay. Not one did.
Not one. Okay.
Not one did. Yeah. And actually, one parent fed back to the school that it opened a dialogue with their son that previously wouldn't have happened.
Okay.
His participation in the module. And I readily understand, as a parent myself, the onus of responsibility on us as parents to support our children in their developing knowledge of sex and sexuality. But I also think realistically, as a society and a culture, it'll probably take another generation before we're mature enough to be having conversations like that. And when we look at countries that have a really good sex education system, like the Nordic countries, that's like there's a collaboration between parents and schools. So the children have a very normalised attitude to an understanding of sex and sexuality and their sexual identity. And I think if we could get to, and I think that'll be really important part of this new programme, is the collaboration between parents and schools.
Okay. Can I ask you, even just Dr. Padraig as well, just on some of the points they're raised by Elaine, and that idea of, I suppose, a kind of a general ORSE curriculum for all, or how that might work?
I really like Coleman's point about why should this sexual health be in some way distinct from your mental health, your emotional health, your physical health, your social well-being. And I think that probably is the window or door or whatever in order to get in there. Because as we know, for the junior cycle, there's 300 hours now that have to, you know, be involved looking at these issues. So I think why see it as something that's completely distinct? It just because, you know, we find it is linked to the developmental transitions that are taking place in alcohol use, in all sorts of different risky behaviours. So it's not different, it is part of, and that will be really important. I must say, it's really important to realise, for example, what I use in the Smart Consent workshops same-sex scenarios, mm. because it's really important to ensure that there's inclusion. And also another scenario that I use is where there is a woman pressurizing a man, because we also know from the statistics that this happens too. And there'll be many people listening this morning who would feel unlistened to in that regard if we don't mention mm-hmm. that point. So yeah, it does have to cover a lot of details. There is a lot of depth, but we should see it as part of a connected picture that we're trying to develop for emotional and social well-being.
Yeah. And just even that point that Elaine mentioned as well, Padraig, just about the fact that it might take the next cycle mm. effectively. We might really just start getting the ball rolling now, but it might be the next, I suppose,
go back to the framework that we have from all the work that's been done on youth policy and that has started to filter out into educational policy. So the whole of school approach is talked about, you know, universally now in any recent educational policy. That is about collaboration between, you know, parents, schools, school authorities, pupils, etc. No, I don't think there's any monitoring of that as to how successful it's been or how prevalent it is. But that's the framework. Okay. And of course, it will depend on the urgency of the priority now that gets behind this. But recent developments show that rapid change can happen. So unfortunately, sometimes it can be as a result of an earthquake, if you like, in social attitudes. And we see a lot of pent up issues that were just very slow moving and underneath the surface. But now is the perfect opportunity, so why not?
Okay, can I just maybe on a final point, Sinead Nugent, just ask you, it was something that was mentioned a little bit earlier as kind of featuring in some of the discussions that you have maybe with kids, and that's about the idea of contraception. Is that something that you think maybe should be brought into this idea of the new RSE curriculum, or is it something that teenagers talk a lot about as well?
Yeah, I agree with Elaine. It is. It's definitely something that they're really interested in learning more about. We would have a contraception kit. It comes from the Irish Family Planning Association. So they provide you with the full works, you know, and the young people get to actually see the pill, the coil, the female condom. That always gets a bit of a laugh. Just all those different types that are available, yeah. you know, and they are kind of amazed at how many are out there. There's a condom demonstration as well that we would do, obviously with consent from the parents. So they are, yeah, I think it's really, really important that that's tied in. It's all interlinked.
Okay.
But again, on the point, Padraig, that you made about the rapid development that could possibly be made, I think that young people are going to help us get there. They're the ones, because it's kind of the older generation that might be more stuck in their ways, but the young people and empowering them to lead out these type of programs, peer education, that could be like a really important part of it too.
Yeah. Okay, we'll leave it there for this morning. Yeah. My thanks to our panel for joining us. Of course, Colman Nocter, child and adolescent psychotherapist at St. Patrick's Mental Health Service. Sinead Nugent from the Spear 17 Regional Youth Service in Dublin. Elaine Burns, a doctoral researcher at the School of Psychology at NUI Galway. And also Dr. Padraig McNeela, a lecturer in psychology at NUI Galway. But for me, Andrea Gilligan, have a great day.
Between the Lines on News Talk.